Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Bridgewater State Hospital makes some very big changes. Also today, author Celeste Eng on how her childhood experiences shaped her writing on families and race.
There was a little bit of the sense of, okay, well, you need to do well in school because otherwise people may make these assumptions about Chinese people. Or, well, you need to make sure to be nice to people because otherwise people will think Chinese people are rude.
Plus, why men are less likely to return to a female doctor.
If a man saw a male doctor for the first time, there was a 50% chance he would return to the same doctor. But that probability fell to 40% for male patients seeing female doctors for the first time.
And there was a big rodeo in town this weekend.
Oh, that is what a professional looks like right there.
But they weren't riding bulls. A visit to the MBTA bus rodeo. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today marks the 16th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th. And at Ground Zero in New York this morning, the names of those killed that day in 2001 were read by family members.
Craig Montano.
Michael G. Montesi.
Carlos Alberto Montoya.
Memorials also took place in Shanksville, Pennsylvania.
Lorraine Grace Bay.
And at the Pentagon.
Charles S. Falkenberg. And his wife, Leslie A. Whittington. And their two children, Dana Falkenberg and Zoe Falkenberg.
Just some of the names of the nearly 3,000 people killed by terrorists on September 11th, 2001. President Donald Trump today laid a wreath at the Pentagon Memorial.
On that day, not only did the world change, but we all changed. Our eyes were opened to the depths of the evil we face. But in that hour of darkness, we also came together with renewed purpose. Our differences never looked so small. Our common bonds never felt so strong. The sacrifice grounds on which we stand today are a monument to our national unity and to our strength.
Boston, too, has an indelible connection to 9/11. Two of the four hijacked planes took off from Logan Airport that day, American Airlines Flight 11 and United Airlines Flight 175. Both planes were crashed into the World Trade Center by hijackers. Outside the Massachusetts State House today, the Ahmadiyya Muslim community hosted their annual Muslims for Life blood drive to honor the victims of 9/11 and to spread a message of hope and peace from the Muslim community. Here's Nasir Rana of Ahmadiyya Boston.
We want to make it unequivocal statement that there is no place for terrorism in Islam. There has never been any place for terrorism in Islam. Islam, as the root word means, peace.
And inside the State House, Massachusetts political leaders came together. Boston Police Superintendent in Chief William Gross spoke at the ceremony.
You can never, ever break our great nation. You can't do it. You never could. We've been the first and greatest nation in the world for a long time, for hundreds of years, because this great nation includes everybody. And I'm not trying to be political in my next statement. No walls, no barriers will ever keep our nation from growing. It's an all-inclusive nation.
And I'll rise up, I'll rise like a day. I'll rise up, rise unafraid, I'll rise up.
That's Berklee College's Astha Shastra performing Rise Up today at the State House.
I'll rise up, high like the waves. I'll rise up.
Sounds from 9/11 memorials today in Boston. Well, let's turn to the day's other news. Michael Resendiz, Globe Spotlight team reporter, joins us now. He's been covering some truly remarkable changes at Bridgewater State Hospital, the state's once deeply troubled facility for male inmates suffering from mental illness. Michael, it's good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, real pleasure.
Absolutely fantastic changes that you documented in your story about Bridgewater State. But first of all, let's just like march back in time a little and remind folks how troubled the facility was not that long ago. I mean, what happened there that led to its need for a dramatic turnaround?
Well, it was a gruesome, horrific place where people who were seriously mentally ill, it's a facility for men, so men who were seriously mentally ill, were strapped down by their wrists and ankles, were held in solitary confinement for months at a time. This is really akin to torture. There's really no other word for it. And people died there.
Yeah.
People died as a result of being placed in four-point restraints. Not only that, but in 2009, when Joshua Messier was killed by guards in his cell, even though his death was ruled a homicide, the State Department of Correction covered it up. No one was disciplined. No one was prosecuted. No one was investigated. The Department of Corrections simply put out a statement that said everything was done according to standard procedure.
And then again, it was the Globe that revealed in 2014 about that cover-up. And so Governor Charlie Baker called for some significant changes. We'll talk in a minute about how those changes took place at Bridgewater State. But you visited recently. What did you see there?
Well, I did visit with a Globe photographer, and I was really taken aback because I had visited Bridgewater State Hospital on a couple of prior occasions. And I got to say, on those prior occasions, it was really kind of a scary place. I visited the intensive treatment unit, ironically named, because that's where people essentially were tortured, tied down by their wrists and ankles or held in solitary confinement. And when I visited last week, I found that the intensive treatment unit was shut down, closed, no more.
No more. And so what's taken its place? What's the feel there? And, you know, what's the sort of the difference in how patients are treated overall?
Well, the patients are treated as people, not as dangerous, subhuman convicts. And the result is really, truly remarkable. The patients that are in there, they're no longer dressed in prison garb. They wear street clothes. So you have people who have a serious mental illness, but they're walking around in Bermuda shorts and T-shirts and sandals. And the security officers and the mental health workers, they're not wearing prison guard uniforms. There are some of the mental health workers there. They wear hospital scrubs. And the whole idea is to make the Bridgewater campus feel more like a hospital than a state prison, even though it still is a state prison.
Yeah. So in a moment, we're going to talk to the assistant hospital administrator at Bridgewater State. But Michael, remind us, it was just this past April, right? Just a couple of months ago when the Baker administration hired a private firm, Correct Care Recovery Solutions. They took over management of the hospital. So all of these changes have taken place in an incredibly short period of time. And advocates are even saying, external advocates who've been tracking the changes say that they're kind of amazed that so much positive change can happen so quickly.
Yes, I talked to the longtime critics of Bridgewater State Hospital. I mean, these are firebrands.
Yeah.
And they were saying that what's happened at Bridgewater State Hospital is astounding, extraordinary. Those were the words they were using. So the fact that this happened so very, very quickly, I think, shows that, you know, we can solve this problem. We can treat people with a mental illness who are involved in the criminal justice system in a humane way and get extraordinary results.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to Michael Resendiz. He's the Boston Globe Spotlight team reporter, talking to us about the dramatic improvements that are being seen at Bridgewater State Hospital, improvements since just this past April, so just the past couple of months. Michael, stand by here for just a moment, if you could, because I'd like to introduce now Kevin Ann Hochshorn. She is the assistant hospital administrator at Bridgewater State Hospital, and she joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Megan. Thanks. Hi, Michael. This is Kevin.
Hello, Kevin.
Yeah. So first of all, Kevin Ann, if you could, can you just walk us through how you implemented some of these changes? I mean, as Michael reporting in his Globe piece, for example, the practice of strapping patients down by their wrists and ankles at Bridgewater State has been cut by 98%. I mean, so what's different that has affected so much change so rapidly?
Well, you're correct, Megan. And I guess I'd first have to say that before we even got there, so many people had come to the table
to work on this really important issue, including the Department of Correction and the Disability Law Center and Department of Mental Health, families of persons served, and, of course, the great work done by the Globe. And then the governor who clearly had great foresight and great compassion, who basically laid out our work for us, which was to operate the facility as a hospital, not a prison, to ensure that each person served, participated in, and got individual treatment plans, and first and foremost, to reduce the use of seclusion and restraint, which this company has a great reputation of doing.
Hmm. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, basically, to do the reduction in seclusion and restraint, we really focus on prevention of the kind of conflicts and violence that lead to having to put hands on people in the first place. And, you know, I really have to hand it to our staff. We brought in a large number of brand new staff who got very fast training and just took to that and changed that training into competencies more quickly than I ever could have imagined in terms of treating people in this hospital like human beings who could be listened to, talked to, that could be included in discussions about their own treatment, and whose needs needed to be met in a very quick manner. Because when you've taken away just about every manner in which an adult could get their own needs met by locking them up into any kind of hospital, staff are now the point people to basically meet those patients' needs and to help them get along and help them feel comfortable and help them feel safe.
Yeah. So if I just may, on that point, I mean, can you clarify for me how much new staff did you bring in and how much of Bridgewater's old staff is still with you? Because in Michael's piece, he talked about that some of the old staff members still had concerns about their safety. And I wonder what changes you made to sort of assure those who stayed on that their safety was still paramount.
Yeah. Well, we have about 500 staff now, and about 400 were brand new, brought on to do this work. And then the remaining staff that had been working at Bridgewater for a long time, you know, I think they probably had to take a deep breath. They were warned by a number of people that this was going to be very dangerous once the officers left, and they had a lot of courage. They got the same training as the new staff, and they're still there. They're doing an awesome job. And they have assimilated into this new culture very, very well. We have lost some people, people that didn't like the work or they didn't want to stay in that work environment. But very, very small numbers of folks have left. Mm. So I think we're coming together. As you pointed out, it's only been about 5 months.
Yeah. Michael, if I can turn back to you for a moment, because it seems like this is a situation in which, as you know, both you and Kevin Ann have been saying, that everybody came together, all the most important stakeholders who were invested in improving, you know, beyond all of us in the Commonwealth as a whole, but who were directly invested in improving the situation at Bridgewater State, did indeed come together. In addition, so did Beacon Hill, right? Because some additional $19 million of funding was authorized to help out Bridgewater State.
Yeah, that's true. And I have to give Governor Baker credit for this. You know, when I started to pay attention to the possibility of reform, and by the way, I should say that there have been many reform efforts over the last several decades that have been announced and either came to nothing or briefly improved things, only to have the entire institution backslide. But I really sat up and took notice when Governor Baker unveiled his reform plans in his State of the State speech in January. I thought he was really putting his name and his reputation and his legacy on the line by doing that. But still, my attitude was, I'll see it when I believe it. Well, now I've seen it, and now I believe it, and give the governor credit for the leadership he's exercised.
Yeah, so that 39% increase in the funding for Bridgewater State Hospital, is that permanent now, or was it one time?
My understanding is that it's one time.
Okay. Oh, it's one time. All right. So, Kevin Ann, is there, while the changes that have been made in the past 5 months are truly remarkable and for the better, do you have any concerns about the sustainability of what you're doing there at the hospital?
In implementing this culture change, this transformation, we're really using a model called the 6 core strategies to prevent violence and conflict and to create a care system that's based on recovery and based on trauma-informed care. And so, no, I don't. What I've noted over the years, I've been doing this work for about 17 years in a number of hospitals, is that the key piece is having sustainable, committed leadership that are involved on the ground and aren't going anywhere. And I can tell you that as far as we're concerned, we're not going anywhere.
Yeah. So there's a real, there's a peculiarity about Bridgewater State that, that some mental health advocates who Michael talked to still pointed out, that Bridgewater State Hospital is still under the Department of Corrections. And in the long run, they'd really like to see it under the Department of Mental Health, because then perhaps we could get, you know, a long-term kind of oversight through the Department of Mental Health that advocates are worried it doesn't have now. I mean, Kevin Ann, do you think that would actually be sort of a an important structural change for Bridgewater State Hospital?
You know, I know that there are a number of people working on that question, and the governor has put together a task force to look at that issue, as well as building a new hospital, but I don't think I'm probably in a position to really address that.
Yeah. Michael Resendiz, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
I was saying what I think the position of some of the advocates I've talked to is that if the facility is transferred to the Department of Mental Health, there will be a lot more protections in place in state law for the people who are at Bridgewater. And so in a way, transferring it to the Department of Mental Health is a safeguard against backsliding, which has happened, in, as I said, in previous years under previous reform proposals.
Yeah.
And, so, and Meghna, I can also just mention that we are using the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health policies and procedures, and we're weaving those into our own to start getting closer and closer to the standard of care, because Massachusetts is widely believed to be a leader in mental health care in the country.
Yeah. You know, this is a story that it is so gratifying to see that so many positive improvements have been made. And Michael, I'm just wondering, I mean, you've been on this for a long time. What do you think ultimately the lessons are to learn from the turnaround that we're seeing at Bridgewater State Hospital?
Well, I got to say, I mean, I have a vested interest in this, but I think what we're seeing here is really the power of the media. I mean, I wrote something like 30 stories over the course of 3 years, and I think it just shows people why we need a strong, independent media to take a look at problems and find out who's responsible and identify some solutions, hold people to account, and then people like Governor Baker can step in and say, hey, we got a real problem here and we need to do something about
it. Yeah, absolutely. Accountability then followed by action, where all the stakeholders come together. I think if we can have more of both, it's better for us all. Michael Resendiz, reporter for the Boston Globe's Spotlight team. Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And Kevin Ann Huckshorn, Assistant Hospital Administrator at Bridgewater State Hospital. True pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for all the work you're doing.
Thank you very much, Magda.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I am delighted to tell you that Celeste Ng joins us in the studio now. Her debut novel, Everything I Never Told You, was award-winning, took home a bunch of awards, including the Massachusetts Book Award and the Asian Pacific American Award for Literature. Now, Celeste is based in Cambridge, but her new book, Little Fires Everywhere, is set in a community of her childhood, Shaker Heights, Ohio, where place, race, family, and identity flow together through Celeste Ng's pen in challenging and unexpected ways. Celeste Ng, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, I don't know if you write your manuscripts with pen or on a computer, but you'll allow me that little literary flourish there. So tell me, I mean, Little Fires Everywhere is a terrific book, but I should note that it's not the only one that you've ever written that Shaker Heights plays an important role in, right?
Well, I've written two books now, and both of them are set in small towns in Ohio. Okay. And in the first book, I chose to sort of make up a fictional town because I was basically, I was afraid to write about a real place because there's a lot of responsibility that comes with writing about a place that exists in the world. And in the second novel, Little Fires Everywhere, I decided to take the plunge and set it in my real-life hometown.
Your real-life hometown. So tell us about Shaker Heights and why you decided to take the plunge this time.
So Shaker Heights is a suburb on the east side of Cleveland. It's a really beautiful place. It's got a lot of trees. It's got a lot of green to it. The houses are beautiful. And my parents moved there in the early 90s because because it's known for having great schools and it's known for being very racially diverse. At the time, it was almost 50-50 black and white, which is very unusual for Cleveland. And so it was a really great place to grow up. And it was only when I moved away that I started to realize it was a little bit unusual.
Yeah. So, but the thing about places that seem like utopia is that, I mean, I guess the common wisdom is that once you scratch the surface of any utopia, you find some dystopian aspects to it. Is that true for Shaker Heights?
I wouldn't say dystopian, but I think that it's fair to say that if you look a little more closely, you can see some of the blind spots that the community still has. It is a very progressive community. It's a place where people are very aware of race, and they talk about race, and they talk about class. And yet, even with all of that attention paid to it, even with that sort of eternal vigilance, there are still blind spots that I think the community has, like any community.
Mm. And so maybe you already answered this, but I'm going to dig a little deeper here. What is it about where you are in your writing career right now that made you decide that, yeah, you could actually set your novel in this real place, that one that you do know so well?
I don't know. It was hubris, I guess, is the answer. But I wanted to try because I had been away from home long enough that I was sort of used to living on my own as an adult, and I had by that time had a child. And I started therefore thinking back to my own childhood, which I think is sort of a natural thing that happens when you become a parent. There's this point of comparison. How was it when I was growing up versus how it is now for my child? And I think thinking about that sort of comparison, comparing the place that I live in now, Cambridge, to the place that I grew up in, comparing the time that we live in now to the time that I grew up in, I would have been a teenager at the time that this book took place in the 90s, that's kind of where that the novel came from, that sort of investigating how far have we come, that question.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about who we meet, who the folks who are at the heart of the novel Little Fires Everywhere. First of all, there's the Richardson family. Really interesting bunch. Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so they are sort of on the outside, at least, the prototypical American suburban family. You know, mother, father. The mother is a journalist for the local paper. The father is a lawyer. They've got four kids who are all like stair-step kids, we used to call them in high school, senior, junior, sophomore, freshman. And they kind of embody the town in a way. They've got roots in the town. The mother's, you know, grandparents live there. And so they're sort of following the rules. They sort of buy into this kind of idea that the town is exceptional in some way and that they're there to set an example.
Right. It's sort of conformity is the word that comes to mind.
But I think so, yeah.
But then in rushes sort of a very, like an opposite force into their lives in the form of Mia Warren and her daughter, Pearl. So tell us about them. And why is it that you decided to bring these two very different types of people together?
Yeah, so Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl come in. They're the strangers from out of town. Mia is in a lot of ways sort of the opposite of this town. She's a wanderer. They move around quite a lot whenever Mia sort of gets the urge. She's an artist, so she doesn't have a very fixed income. She doesn't have a very stable career. And they basically move around in their car. So they have almost no material possessions. They kind of just take whatever they can fit into their car. And they're sort of polar opposites to the Richardson family. And I was really interested in the idea of those two families kind of being drawn to each other. So often you're interested in people who live a life that's really different from yours.
Yeah. So this is, in my reading of it, there's a deep common theme that that courses through the Richardson family, through Mia Warren and her daughter, and another family also in the book, and that is sort of how do we define parent-child relationships, especially when either those children aren't biologically born as a part of their family, or B, even your biological children are perhaps attracted to the parents of another family because they're getting something from that other person that they may not be getting from their own mother and father. I mean, that's a really complicated web. I'm mixing my metaphors now. A complicated web to wade into. But what is it about those kind of relationships that you find so interesting as a novelist?
Well, I've always been interested in the parent-child relationships and the ways that parents, even though you'd think they would be the ones who would understand their children the best, and as a parent, I like to think that I understand my child the best, That's not always true, unfortunately. Sometimes you're so close to your own child that you can't see who they really are or what they really need. And in the novels, you said there are a lot of mother-daughter, mother-child pairings, both between the mother that you're born to and the mother that you sort of choose, or maybe the mother that chose you. And you get different things from those. And, of course, your own mother sometimes has feelings about it if you're, you know, turning to another person as a mother figure.
I mean, so to speak specifically about it, like Pearl and Izzy here, right? Like Pearl there's a part of her that's really compelled by Mrs. Richardson, and Izzy finds something very compelling in Mia, right?
Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think they're drawn to the woman who's very unlike their own mother. Izzy is sort of drawn to Mia's sort of self-expression and her free spirit. And Pearl, who's always been moved around, is sort of drawn to this sort of very stable, upright pillar of the society sort of figure.
Has that ever happened to you?
I feel like, you know, I'm lucky that I've had a really good relationship with my mother, but my mom is her own specific person. And, you know, my mom is a scientist. She's a chemist. She taught PhD students, and she does research in the lab. And I clearly have turned myself in a slightly different direction as a writer. And so I feel like there have been other women in my life that I turn to for just different kinds of mentoring.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of women feel that. I think my sisters probably felt that. And, you know, friends of mine, you find people that you turn to, and there's often a moment where you go, well, wait, am I betraying my own mother in some way by turning to this other person for advice?
So I know exactly how you feel. I mean, it's funny, your mom's a chemist, so is mine.
Really?
I mean, and I adore my mother, but she's a chemist. She's very sort of logic and accomplishment oriented. And of course, also being an immigrant, an American by choice, there was always that drive from the beginning to, you know, like there are life goals. And so I got that drive from her. But I did find that maybe not so much when I was younger, but in my teen years, and funnily enough, in my 20s and 30s, just like you said, like in other women, I found sort of other aspects of ways of being that nurtured me that I didn't get from my mother.
Yeah, I think that's basically exactly the experience I had. My mother, also an immigrant, you know, an American by choice. She came over in the 60s, you know, went to school, got her PhD, has been, you know, working here, you know, until she retired a few years ago. And she's very, you know, she's very much in the science mode of thinking. She's very logical. She's very problem-solving oriented, and she gets things done. And I got that from her. But at the same time, every now and then there are times where you, as you said, you want to experience a different way of being in the world, or a different way of relating to the world. And I feel like that's natural, and yet it also, I had a lot of guilt about
me
that.
Me too. It's very, it makes you feel really fraught, because it feels like a kind of, as you're saying, a little bit of a betrayal, even though it's not, but it feels that way.
That's exactly it, and I think about it now as a parent, as I know you are also, where I sort of think, well, what about those moments where your kid says, oh yeah, but I want to go over to that person's house because their mom does this, you know, or no, I want to do that with grandma. And there's a little bit where you're like, oh,
yeah.
You don't want to do that with me, huh?
Yeah. I mean, I find myself, it's like I'm coming back around finally to a deeper appreciation of my mother now that I've got my own children to mother.
That's
well.
Exactly where I am as well, where I'm sort of now. I feel like there are certain things where I understand why she did things when I was a kid, or I see things now from her point of view in a way that I thought I did before, but I realize that I really didn't quite understand before. And now I feel like I'm starting to understand a little better.
Well, this seems like a great place for me to ask you if you could read an excerpt from Little Fires Everywhere, because I want folks to hear your writing. The writing's also beautiful as well. So could you do that?
Sure. So this is just to frame it, a little passage in which Mia, who is the mother who comes from out of town, is thinking about her relationship with her daughter, Pearl. After Pearl had begun to snore softly, Mia kept her hand in place, as if she were a sculptor shaping Pearl's shoulder blades. She could feel Pearl's heart, ever so faintly, beating under her palm. It had been a long time since her daughter had let her be so close. Parents, she thought, learned to survive touching their children less and less. As a baby, Pearl had clung to her. She'd worn Pearl in a sling because whenever she'd set her down, Pearl would cry. There'd been scarcely a moment in the day when they had not been pressed together. As she got older, Pearl would still cling to her mother's leg, then her waist, then her hand, as if there were something in her mother she needed to absorb through the skin. Even when she had her own bed, she would often crawl into Mia's in the middle of the night and burrow under the old patchwork quilt, and in the morning they would wake up tangled, Mia's arm pinned beneath Pearl's head, or Pearl's legs thrown across Mia's belly. Now, as a teenager, Pearl's caresses had become rare, a peck on the cheek, a one-armed, half-hearted hug, and all the more precious because of that. It was the way of things, Mia thought to herself, but how hard it was. The occasional embrace, a head leaned for just a moment on your shoulder, when what you really wanted, more than anything, was to press them to you and hold them so tight you fused together and could never be taken apart. It was like training yourself to live on the smell of an apple alone, when what you really wanted was to devour it, to sink your teeth into it and consume it, seeds, core, and all.
Oh, that's Celeste Ng reading from her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere. Oh, that really gets to me, Celeste, I have to say, because right now I have both my kids are in single digits, so, and every time their sort of Velcro-y nature gets to me, I'm gonna reread this passage and remind myself that I will miss it.
I'm in exactly soon. The same spot with my son has just started first grade, and he's very into being independent, and then every so often he's very clingy, and I have to kind of remind myself, you're going to miss that.
I'm going to miss it. I'm going to think about the smell of an apple. So there's also this aspect of the book, which is really important that we haven't touched on yet, and it has to do with sort of how we define and how society defines what an appropriate family actually is, right? Because there's also the story in the novel about a white family raising a Chinese baby.
Mm-hmm. There's been a Chinese baby that's been abandoned at the fire station, and she's been adopted by a well-to-do white family living in Shaker Heights that are friends of the Richardsons. And one of the subplots of the novel has to do with the mother of this Chinese baby who kind of wants her child back. And the question of who this child belongs to, whose mother, you know, who is the child's mother, right, in terms of the law, but also in terms of actual sort of psychology. Who is it, the mother who gave birth to her, or is it the mother who's been taking care of her? And it leads, in fact, to a sort of conflict in the community that actually divides the entire community and causes a split between the Richardsons and between Mia and Pearl.
I mean, is there, at the risk of sounding too simplistic, does your opinion fall on one side or the other?
I can't decide, honestly. It sounds like an authorial cop-out, but one of the things that I wanted to do was just sort of to pose this question and to show how complicated this situation is, that both of these mothers, really both of these sets of parents, have a claim on this child and love this child and have a reason to want this child in their lives, and that whichever family the child ends up with, unfortunately, she's going to be missing something.
Yeah, interesting. You know, the novel takes sort of grapples with sex, abortion, surrogacy, adoption, as we've been just talking about, abandonment. I mean, you pack in a lot, almost every aspect about, you know, the way we don't or don't have children. First of all, how'd you do it? And second of all, why?
I guess it was just something on my mind. The more I started to work on the novel, the more that it started to kind of give me clues about what it wanted to be. That sounds very new agey. But I do think there's a point at which the novel picks up a certain amount of momentum for itself, and it starts to sort of resonate with itself. And so once I started thinking about mothers and daughters or mothers and children, more sort of mother-child pairings kept coming up, and they started to sort of echo each other in ways that felt like they were adding to the story. And so, as you said, these questions of abortion, or these questions of adoption, or these questions of surrogacy, and the questions of infertility, all of the sort of ways that I think we have ideas as a society about how people should have children, whether they should have children, who gets to, who deserves to. All of that sort of started to wind itself up into the ball of the story, so to speak.
And you do it so very well, I have to say. Finally, I just wonder, you know, we talked a little bit about how your upbringing in Shaker Heights, we talked about our mothers as well. I mean, how much do you appreciate... Maybe I'm asking this as a person who speaks to a lot of authors, and sometimes I wonder, should I be sort of saying, like, here's an author that, in part because of her own ethnic background, engages a lot with issues of ethnicity and race? Because I always wonder if authors, like, push back against that because they're also just writing great stories.
No, I feel both sides of that question, actually, because especially when I started off as a debut author, I was really nervous about being pigeonholed.
Right, as the new Chinese-American
exactly,
writer.
Right, yeah. The, the next Amy Tan. Like, there can only be one, and somebody has to knock her off the pedestal in order to, you know, get anywhere. Which is something that I really, really struggle against and really push back against now that I have a little bit of a voice. I think as a writer of color, you know, somebody who's been in marginalized situations in different ways, I think that I'm really aware of what it's like to be an outsider. And so even when I'm writing, as in this novel, about many characters who are white, I still think that I bring to it the perspective of what it's like to be an outsider and how hard that can be and how that can shape someone.
Yeah. Well, what I really appreciated in the book is that even though it's set in the 90s, as you said, it still felt thoroughly modern, sort of it just in the matter of fact way that the characters sort of interact with each other, that obviously ethnicity and race and heritage are issues, but they're not like the immediate defining issues. So I think that's the way most of us on a day-to-day basis, hopefully that's the way a lot of us live.
Hopefully so. I think, you know, I don't usually walk around going like I'm Asian walking down the street and I'm Asian eating my lunch. But I think you're touching on something that I'm realizing as this book is coming out into the world, that I started it in 2009. And when I was writing it, the world was in a very different place.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the book is set in the 90s. And now I'm realizing both how far we've come and also maybe how far we have not come.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, the new novel is Little Fires Everywhere. Celeste Eng will be speaking tomorrow night at Porter Square Books about it. We've got a lot more information about the novel at our website, radioboston.org. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Celeste. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on the book. It's terrific.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And look who sauntered in at the break, Carrie Goldberg.
Hey, Meghna.
Let me just start off by asking you, Carrie, how important a role does gender play in the patient-doctor relationship?
How important a role does gender play in the patient-doctor relationship? There's no way I'm falling for that. That is a trap question because the only answer is, of course, a great big fat it depends, right? it depends on the patient, on the doctor, on the procedure. Is it an intimate, like, pelvic exam or prostate exam? Is it just an eye exam? You know, so it depends on the intimacy of what's going on. But so it's a very juicy question, but I can give you some nice dry data
okay.
to answer it.
Okay, so hang on.
Okay.
I should probably introduce you.
Oh, that.
Even though
yeah.
you are with us every Monday, mm-hmm. for those few people who don't know who you are. Carrie is the host of WBUR's Common Health blog, and she talks to us on Mondays about issues of health and medicine. Okay, so Carrie, about that dry data regarding patient-doctor relationships and gender, give me some numbers.
Okay, so here you go. So these come from Athena Health. It's a big local electronic medical record software company that is able to mine interesting data from medical records. So Athena Health took a look at more than 2 million medical visits starting in 2014. And they found that if you're a man and you go to a primary care doctor for the first time and that doctor is a woman, you're significantly less likely to go back for a second visit.
Okay, so to clarify, does that mean that men are less likely to return to a female doctor than if the doctor were a man?
Correct.
Okay.
And also that the men are less likely to go back than if you, the patient, were a woman.
I got you. Okay.
So, in fact, female patients were about as likely to return to a female doctor after a first visit as they were to a male doctor. So gender of the doctor wasn't really mattering for the female patients.
But it was for the male patients.
Right.
I see. Okay.
Right. So here's Josh Gray. He's Athena Health's vice president of research.
It was men where we saw a bigger difference. So if a man saw a male doctor for the first time, there was a 50% chance he would return to the same doctor for a second visit within a year and a half. But that probability fell to 40% for male patients seeing female doctors for the first time.
So not a huge difference, 50% to 40%, but a notable one, right? Like enough to make you say, huh, what's going on there?
Well, I have thoughts.
As you always
I
do.
I always have thoughts,
you
but you've spoken to the expert. So do we, in fact, know what's going on?
Well, so we have some clues. And so now we go from the quantitative to the qualitative. Qualitative research, like some people said some stuff, right? That's qualitative. So Athena Health posted these results on their website, and they were inundated with comments. Here's how that same vice president, Josh Gray, describes the response.
One particular tripwire for at least some male patients is they really don't like to experience an intimate exam or procedure if there are more than one female healthcare providers in the room. So that could be a female doctor and a nurse, or a doctor and a medical assistant. But judged by some of the qualitative comments, there's a lot of men that are just not comfortable with that type of visit.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, one commenter on their website said, you know, men that might be willing to have an intimate exam or a procedure with a female physician are not necessarily comfortable with her bringing in a female nurse or other female staff member, like an assistant or a chaperone. So that can take what was a tolerable situation and make it unacceptable to them. And most men are too embarrassed to speak up, and instead they find it easier to just not go back to that doctor.
So some men are uncomfortable by being the objects of examination for multiple women. I would say that women have had to experience that for quite some time in the reverse.
Yes, and I would say two wrongs don't make a right, right? Like that, in fact, if what's happening is that men's sensitivities are not coming to the fore or are not being addressed, or they're not being consented, you know, asked for their consent enough, then maybe that's a problem too, right?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, like, you're right. Two wrongs don't make a right here. Mm-hmm. But here, let me ask you a question. Most medical support staff, I mean, because the guy from Athena Health was saying a little earlier, like, you know, when a nurse comes in, mm-hmm. they tend to be women, right? Mm-hmm. So if this indeed is a problem, it's going to happen a lot.
It is going to be happening a lot, yes. But there may also be other factors at work besides this, discomfort with more than one woman during an intimate exam. So when I wrote about this on Common Health, I headlined the post, "Male patients are likelier to bail on female doctors. The question is why." And one healthcare expert emailed me this very snarky, like, basically, sexism and misogyny? Could it be that?
Yes.
So,
yeah.
You know,
okay.
So,
I mean, look, I'm not trying to be snarky, Carrie. I'm really not here. But I think that your healthcare expert that emailed you, I'm on his or her side. But let me also ask you this. There is a power dynamic in any doctor-patient relationship, and it's a mm-hmm. tricky one to navigate, right? And
yep,
so
sure.
if there's a sense that the doctor has the power and the doctor is a woman, perhaps, you know, are there men who may be uncomfortable with that?
I mean, you know, there very well could be, or there could be something a little subtler. So I spoke with Professor Judith Hall, who's in the psychology department at Northeastern University, and she studied how gender plays out in medicine. And in particular, she and others have found that generally, now this is just general, this is just statistical, women doctors tend to perform a bit better on many aspects of medical care, particularly on listening and empathy. And yet she finds that patients tend to kind of shortchange women doctors on the things that they're better at. And instead they see it as being kind of like, well, she's just being a woman. That's part and parcel of being a woman.
When a patient sees a female doctor doing all these really good patient-centered things, they don't represent it in their minds as, ooh, this is a great doctor. They represent it as, she's being a woman. You know, this is what women do. This is how women act. But they don't connect it to the idea of doctoring. Whereas if the male physician shows all the patient-centered skills and behaviors, it stands out and it's really connected in the patient's mind to, wow, this is a great doctor.
Okay, Carrie, so let me cut to the chase here, because mm-hmm. this is really fascinating and very important for a couple of reasons. One is that I feel like, especially in primary care, we're seeing a lot more female doctors.
Yep.
And second of all, this seems like a wake-up call for doctors as a whole, because if indeed there are a significant number of men who are uncomfortable in the exam room, we want to do what we can to help them come, to have them return to get medical care. We don't want them to be too afraid to come back.
Right, especially because men tend to be a little worse about going to get their medical care. So yes, and it seems like it could be sort of a backfiring of this idea, well, let's have an extra person in the room to make people feel more comfortable. In fact, men might be feeling less comfortable, and medical practices want to retain their patients, so they have an incentive to try to fix this.
So maybe there's a simple solution here. Asking the patient what would make them most comfortable?
That's a very good solution, Magna. It doesn't always happen in the rush of the, you know, what's going on, but that is called consent, and it is a good thing.
It is always a good thing in healthcare and just about everything, honestly. Yep. Yep. Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. There's a link to her post about men not feeling comfortable when female medical care providers are in the room. It's at our website, radioboston.org, a link to that. Carrie, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Okay, now, also, you're not going to want to leave the studio, Carrie, because we're going to finish the show today talking about a rodeo that was in town. And our producer, Allison Bruzek, was there, and she joins us now. Hi, Allison.
Hi, Vegna. Does that pun work on air? Rodeo?
Rodeo.
R-O-A-D.
So what, what was this? Rodeo.
So over the weekend, the MBTA had their bus rodeo, which is basically, imagine 15 drivers, closed course obstacle race, and they're just going through all these obstacles, like seven of them set up, and they have to get through all of them, and they have to have no dings. So like, you can't knock over a cone, you can't knock over a barrel, you can't run over a tennis ball, and whoever does it the best wins and is the champion.
A bus rodeo. I love everything about this. Now, you were there, you brought us back an audio postcard, so let's listen to that.
I don't want to make anybody nervous, but Operator Kaplis is making great time on his run on the course. I haven't seen any cones on the ground.
My name is Billy Cameron. This is my third year doing the announcing. Typically, we have an instructor do it. I'm actually the superintendent of training, and I like it so much that I decided just to keep the job.
That's Ron Saka washing the windows over there. That's a nice touch. Remember, guys, a clean bus is an aerodynamic bus.
There are a bunch of obstacles that the operators have to maneuver around throughout the course. This, as we call this, is going through the balls. It's like you have to go through without touching a ball, either side of the balls, with either tire, inside or outside. Next, we go to the left-hand turn. Very difficult because it just barely fits the length of the bus. After that, we have our first of two bus stops. We have a serpentine over in the middle. And then the final one, the fun one, is the barrels. You have to be going at least 20 miles an hour through the barrels without touching them and stop within a foot of that cone at the end. But it's pretty treacherous to drive.
And now here he comes through the barrels. Oh, that is what a professional looks like right there.
My name is Reynaldo Biro. I've been driving for 21 years. I was last year's champion at the local bus rodeo.
Here comes the defending MBTA bus rodeo champion, Ronaldo Abito.
What's the secret to driving a bus well?
Well, in this competition or in any situation is setting up the mirrors correctly. That's the main thing.
That's how a champion does it, just like that. That's exactly how a champion does it.
I think a lot of people's favorite parts is the barrels at the end. So my name is Holly Durso, and I'm Director of Transportation Safety here at the T. It's equally exciting when the barrels come flying at you and when someone goes through without hitting any. So it's a good way to end the course, I think.
Threading the needle right through those barrels.
You have to be a certain type of person to be a bus driver for the MBTA. You have to be a people person first and most of all. My name is Bill Berardino. I am the bond captain for the Charlestown Garage. I've been a contestant for 10 years, but I've been on the job 14. The camaraderie between all these drivers, they're all good people, good drivers. It's a bond that everybody looks forward to seeing each other every year here. It's a great job. It's a great career at the T.
Here goes Grandios through the barrels. Careful, Sal. Careful, Sal. That is going to be tough to beat, everybody.
Oh, my God. The 41st annual MBTA Bus Rodeo. Allison Bruzek brought us that amazing audio postcard. Was it as fun in being there in person as it sounded like in the audio postcard?
It is truly an amazing experience. And these are the safest drivers. So these are people with a clean record, like no accidents. But this course is so hard that we were setting up GoPros to take video. Robin Lovick, our photographer extraordinaire, and I. And like, we didn't know where to put them because we were like, oh, let's put them on the barrels. But then we just watched bus after bus after bus crash these barrels off. And we were like, well, there's no way we're going to do that. But our video does have a bus eyes view of going through this whole obstacle course and then on the ground as the buses are going by and squishing all these balls. It's actually amazing.
Awesome. So that's at radioboston.org. Definitely check it out. Now we've been holding on to the most amazing thing of all. You drove one of the buses, Allison?
I drove one of the buses. And I'm going to give full credit to the instructor who stood literally at my arm the entire time, Chanel Mercer, and was telling me and walking me through it and keeping me cool because I was not entirely sure that I was going to get through a passage where there were buses on either side of me and I was driving this bus forward. It is a hard feat. It is a very... There are multiple knobs. There's things on your feet. There's like extra buttons. You have to listen for different sounds. All the while, you're attempting to drive and avoid the things in Boston.
No, I was just gonna say, like, I feel like the real rodeo is what they have to drive through every day.
It's so
on the
true.
Streets of Radio Boston. Uncontrolled wild animals, aka cyclists and pedestrians and other drivers.
Other drivers.
Getting in the way. Well, that's Radio Boston producer Allison Bruzek bringing us the sounds of the 41st annual MBTA Bus Rodeo. Again, we've got a video of it at radioboston.org. Allison, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carrie, it's your next job.
I know.
Just kidding.
I want to see how many passengers I can knock over when I turn.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.